The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, featuring great leaders in human progress, brought to you by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of A Book of Meditations and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Lincoln, the prophetic American. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friend, to Lincoln, the nation turned in its hour of sorest trial. On him it laid its heaviest burden. Through him, the Union was reborn, slavery eliminated, and present-day America made possible. He stands increasingly as our most representative American in character and leadership, prophetic of all we hope democracy will someday be. Born in Kentucky in 1809, Lincoln was of wandering frontier stock that had long forgotten its New England ancestry. Contrasting with his rather unstable father, Lincoln's mother was fine, sensitive, deeply emotional, a rare flower of the forest. When Lincoln was 7, his father moved to southern Indiana, where the family lived for a year in a three-sided shack with an open front, then rising to the dignity of a four-walled cabin. The frontier hardships were too much for the tender mother. She died when her son was a lad of 10 and was buried in a lonely grave in the forest. Lincoln's schooling was limited to a few irregular months, but a born student, he absorbed the few great books he could obtain. Among them was a copy of Indiana Statutes containing the Declaration of Independence. That document took profound hold on Lincoln's mind, and he based his whole career on the ideas of Jefferson, considering him the greatest statesman America has had. At 19, Lincoln had reached his full height of 6'4", sober and clean living, liked generally for his friendliness and storytelling. He was a solitary, brooding soul within. His first sight of the outside world came through a trip to New Orleans as hand on a flatboat. At 21, he helped his father trek across to central Illinois, and then struck out for himself. A New Salem merchant sent him again to New Orleans with a shipment of freight. On this trip, he had the shock of seeing the slave market. Out of a job through his employer's failure, Lincoln decided to start an independent business. He and his friend Berry procured a stock on credit and opened as general merchants. But Berry was given to drink, and Lincoln wanted to read all the time. He would walk 20 miles to Springfield to borrow a book, and now made Shakespeare and Burns his life companions. In a barrel of rubbish bought of a traveler for a half dollar, Lincoln found Blackstone's Commentaries and eagerly absorbed that law classic. The business failing, Lincoln assumed the entire partnership debt and paid it faithfully through 15 years, evidencing the integrity of character that made him great. After a term in the legislature, he became village postmaster, carrying the mail around in his hat, always his favorite receptacle. At this time, he experienced his one deep love affair with sweet, lovely Ann Rutledge, whose death plunged him into his first spiritual crisis. It wakened him to realize how frail the foundation is on which our happiness ever rests. It was then he came to love the poem, whose refrain became his favorite line of verse, "Oh, why should the spirit of mortal be proud?" While serving several more terms in the legislature, Lincoln assiduously studied law, and at 28 moved to Springfield, which he and his friends had just made the state capital, to begin practice. After 4 years of training with Judge Logan, he formed a partnership with Herndon that continued for life. There was much of the Hamlet tendency in Lincoln. As his ideas developed, they became fixed bases of conduct. But in personal matters, he was vacillating, subject to long periods of depression. This shows in his relation with Mary Todd, a little woman of high southern family, excellent finishing school education, keen social ambition, and a quick, not always controlled temper. Why did she turn to Lincoln? She was courted at the same time by the affable, cultivated Stephen A. Douglas. Was it that her love saw through Lincoln's awkward exterior and gave some sense of his coming greatness? Why did Lincoln turn to her? Was it his longing for feminine society, his feeling that she was all he was not in social cultivation? Whatever the explanation, after an engagement alike broken and resumed under strange circumstances, they were married. Lincoln was a loyal husband and a tender father to his children. His wife helped him with good practical judgment and was wholly faithful to his cause in the war, though her near relatives were fighting with the Confederate forces. It may be, however, that Lincoln's domestic setting only accentuated the brooding solitariness of his spirit. At 37, Lincoln ran for Congress and was elected in spite of being attacked as aristocrat and infidel. He made little impression at Washington and returned wondering if he were fit for public life. Offered the governorship of Oregon, he would have accepted but for his wife's vigorous protest, which saved him for a national career. He now turned energetically to his law practice, going from court to court in a ramshackle buggy with a pokey old horse, but remaining on circuit and studying late into the night, endeavoring to remedy the defects of his education. His success as a lawyer came from his deep ethical grasp, and he got on well only when sure of the justice of his client's cause. Meanwhile, war clouds were gathering. At that time, there was a combination of vested interests in the party founded by Jefferson to protect the people against such interests. The great slave owners, demanding ever more land to exploit, were financed by the moneyed interests of the North. Lincoln said the reversal of party form reminded him of a fight he had witnessed between two drunken men, which concluded with each wearing the other's overcoat. Conciliating the slave owners, Douglas, as senator from Illinois, engineered the repeal of the Missouri Compromise on the ground that the people of a territory should be free to decide for themselves whether to be a slave or a free state. Knowing the problem in his own family, and basing himself on the principles of Jefferson, Lincoln held that the nation needed the new territories as homes for poor white people, where they could work hard, rear their families, and advance their lives without degrading competition with slave labor. Expressed in his Peoria speech when campaigning for the Senate in 1854, this conviction became the fixed first half of Lincoln's life program. The conflict followed in bleeding Kansas, and then the Dred Scott decision, which seemed to throw the whole nation open to slavery. In 1858, the newly formed Republican Party asked Lincoln to run for the Senate against Douglas, then up for re-election. Lincoln had not joined that party at its founding. He waited a year and a half to see whose overcoat it would wear. Only when he became convinced that it was then wearing the overcoat of Thomas Jefferson that was founded to protect poor white people from the interests combined in the opposing party, did he accept its nomination. In his acceptance speech, he laid down the second half of his life program, affirming that a house divided could not stand, and the Union must finally become all slave or all free. Douglas reluctantly accepted Lincoln's challenge to debate the issues in each congressional district in Illinois. That series of debates was the greatest ever held. Lincoln began it a backwoods lawyer, hardly known outside central Illinois. He closed it a national figure, widely talked of for president. He deliberately sacrificed his chance of election by asking Douglas questions that revealed the consequences of the Dred Scott decision and the Missouri Compromise repeal. Following the election, Lincoln subsided into one of his long periods of depression, for he was keenly ambitious of place and recognition at the hands of his fellows. In February 1860, he went east to lecture in Plymouth Church, Brooklyn, but arrived to find the meeting was to be in Cooper Union with an audience of statesmen. The East was intensely curious to see and hear the widely caricatured, uncouth prophet from the wilderness. Lincoln hastily recast his speech, focusing it on the great issue. He was generous toward the Southern leaders, deprecated the John Brown raid, held that the South should be left free to settle its own problem, but urged that slavery should be confined there and not be allowed to spread to the free states and national territories. He closed with these ringing words, "Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it." That speech put Lincoln in the White House. The fight between Greeley and Seward at the Chicago Republican Convention threw the nomination to Lincoln on the third ballot. There were four candidates: Breckinridge, pro-slavery; Douglas, standing for those who would put the slavery issue aside; Bell, representing those who would not join the Republicans, fearing the abolitionists, nor the Democrats, fearing slavery; and Lincoln. 4.5 million votes were cast. Lincoln, receiving less than 2 million, was elected. Taking the election of a Republican president as a direct challenge, the South Carolina senators resigned, and within 6 weeks, South Carolina seceded. President Buchanan sent into Congress a weak and frightened message. At home in Illinois, Lincoln said to his law partner, "Billy, you know you sometimes have a case in court, and before you get there, your fellow lawyer goes into court and gives away the case. Well, President Buchanan is giving away the case." So six states followed South Carolina, and the Confederacy was established weeks before Lincoln reached Washington. His inaugural address was generous to the South, but affirmed that the Union must be preserved, and to that end, federal posts in seceding states would be held. The storm centered on Fort Sumter. With its fall and the secession of four more states, the war was on. Lincoln's burden was almost insuperable. Many in the Union held the political philosophy on which the South seceded. The abolitionists at first opposed the war and bitterly attacked Lincoln. A vicious cabal in Congress fought his every move and tried to take from him the war powers. It was not until the summer of 1862 that he finally emerged, inflexible in action as he had been in ideas. Hamlet, at last, had become Prospero. In September, as a war measure, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation. After Gettysburg, Lincoln was sure the Union would win the war, and he turned to what would come after, endeavoring to forestall hate by his amnesty proclamation. Meantime, the politicians were abroad, discovering, to their chagrin, that Lincoln had become the people's hero. Why? It was his utter integrity of character. He made grave mistakes, but he meant absolutely right. With this, it was his tenderness, mercy, and humanity. That response of the people to Lincoln is a supreme reason for keeping our faith in democracy, for it proves that in the breast of common men and women is an instinctive power to respond to the highest when it clearly appears. With Grant's campaign, the war entered its last phase. After those terrible losses in the wilderness, Lincoln spoke in Philadelphia, quoted Grant's words, and added, "We're going through on this line if it takes 3 years more of war." When the news of his second nomination came, he remarked, "I suppose they didn't want to swap horses crossing a stream." The worst attack of all, by leaders of his own party, followed. But the people rallied to him, and he was reelected. His second inaugural address was a statement of the idea achieved, the Union. In a Washington speech 2 days after Lee's surrender, Lincoln said, "The Southern states should be treated as if they had never left the Union, a magnanimity unequaled in any other victory in history." He had aged tragically during the war, but now the burden was rolled away. On April 14th, he went for a long drive with Mrs. Lincoln, talking freely and happily with her about their future. That evening, he went to the theater party she had planned at Ford's Theater. You know the last chapter, John Wilkes Booth, half crazed by the sufferings of his people, crept behind the presidential box and shot Lincoln through the head from behind. He died the next morning, 56 years old, centuries old, with a burden he had borne so long. Booth's shot was the worst blow the South ever received, worse than any invading campaign, even than Sherman's merciless march to the sea. It put the little men in the saddle, the little men who hate, resulting in the wickedness of the Reconstruction period, which would have been avoided had Lincoln lived. In the end, his more generous ideas prevailed, giving us the unified nation we love and cherish today. It was Lincoln's greatness that he did the work of Alexander Hamilton on the basis of the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, uniting the two strands of political philosophy so long dividing our people, uniting them, let us hope, for our entire future.
Lincoln, the prophetic American, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Browning, the Friend of the Spirit. Copies of tonight's discussion of Lincoln may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This educational feature has been presented from Cleveland. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
McCutcheon,